Can everyone please take a seat? We're going to get started. My name is Patrick Heller, and I will be chairing this session. We're going to go till 1 o'clock since we're running a little bit late. And our first speaker will be Diane Davis, and Diane has 20 minutes.
Set up show. Let me just sit down. Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me to this conference. I have to say, I was really excited to see the theme of the conference because I wrote a book about middle classes in the developing world that came. I started in the mid-90s. It came out about 5 years ago, and now maybe somebody will read it after you guys start. Yeah, Patrick, I know. But it was really framed more in the context of development, but it's really a book about middle-class formation, so I'm really excited about the conversation we're starting and bringing it up to the present and looking at the in a broader, much broader way about the developing world. I'm going to read my remarks. My aim here is to reflect on the empirical evidence drawn from this prior work that I mentioned. The book is called Discipline and Development, and my prior work on Mexico City, and I'm really happy to be on a panel with Landy and really looking forward to hearing what she has to say about the Mexico City context. But I've worked for a while on the relationship between middle classes, politics, urbanization, and national development in Latin America and East Asia, and I want to use that kind of past work that I've done looking at prior historical developmental trajectories to reflect, to establish some general analytical and methodological principles for examining the contemporary middle classes in the so-called developing world, and then to offer some tentative hypotheses about contemporary changes and challenges to middle class formation and middle class politics. You notice I added politics to the title because I liked very much the two-pager that you guys sent out about what you were interested in, why you got excited about looking at middle classes and politics. Both politics and urbanization were both important, and I wanted to try to bring both of them in some way. And I want to look at how those changes in the hypothesis will focus on challenges to middle-class formation and middle-class politics generated by accelerated urbanization and ongoing economic globalization processes that are rapidly transforming the global south. I start from the premise that any serious understanding of middle classes, their role in politics, and how they produce or are produced by development trajectories in today's globalizing world must take space seriously. And so, again, there's the element in my talk, I'm been focusing on space in a variety of ways, but I also want to underscore that I'm adding one more element, kind of building on the conversation that's already started, which is the context of late industrialization or late development, the kind of political economy, larger political economy context of the discussion that began with this morning's panel. I think that I want most of the remarks about the contemporary period, the hypotheses for all of us who are studying the developing world now, draw from a focus on the case of Mexico. But I've developed a lot of my general remarks, the first part of the remarks about what I've learned from studying other countries in the past, and my contemporary remarks focused on an understanding of similarities and differences across several other country contexts that I know relatively well. So in addition to Mexico, there is Argentina, South Korea, Taiwan, South Africa, and a little bit about India, although I shudder to say that with all the experts of India here. So much of my prior work on the role of middle classes in the developing world, as I said, revolved around my interest in why particular macroeconomic development trajectories materialized in the first place, why East Asia was so successful and Latin America was so failed. But before I got to that book, I wrote my first serious piece of research was a study of the growth of Mexico City, a book called Urban Leviathan, where I really also realized in retrospect that I was looking at the ways that urbanization, and the growth and political governance of the city, the capital city, affected national political and economic development and vice versa. So what I thought started out as a study of urbanization, which is now, of course, coming back in, everybody's interested in urbanization, was really about macroeconomic development. And in that first book, focused on Mexico City, I traced patterns of macroeconomic development to key bargains struck between capital, labor, and the state. That was a historical study from 1910 to 1980. But in those bargains, I found, as I was finishing the book, that the urban middle classes played a key political role in two distinct ways. One, they lent stable political support to the state in the face of opposition from ideological extremes. And second, they variously sided with particular factions of capital or labor in key moments of time, with their alliances determining the extent to which Mexico pursued a populist as opposed to a neoliberal development strategy. So I looked at different variations in the development paradigms or models used in Mexico. And in making that argument, I found two sets of middle-class subgroupings to be particularly relevant as allies for molding larger development trajectories. One were the public sector employees, on one hand, and on the other hand, small and medium-sized commercial and industrial producers on the other. So the first point I'm making here is that my own research on middle classes takes a very different perspective than the conversation than the kind of assumptions that we are starting with now, which is the middle classes are the educated salaried professionals. I have a long discussion in the appendix of my second book, The Discipline and Development, about how and why I defined middle class. So the question of how you define a tools question is absolutely central. I struggled with it myself in that book because there was very little written when I started researching this in 1994 about middle classes in the developing world. And the starting point was always the West, the advanced capitalist world's definition of middle classes and how we might look at the developing world. And obviously you can see that's a non-starter, which is probably why there wasn't more work done on middle classes. So I came to be interested in middle classes by doing empirical work on seeing which actors were really involved in affecting development strategies. Then when I decided to look more systematically at middle classes comparatively and historically across the developing country context, I was struggling because in the Mexico case, I had the empirical evidence of who was involved and why they were involved, but then I had to find a theoretical perspective or a definition. So in that appendix, which I didn't spend any time to talk about, but let me just say I would love to have people make comments and criticisms about that now in light of the contemporary project of looking at middle classes where we are starting to see salaried professionals, educated professionals, because in my definition, they were almost non-existent in the politics of the things I was looking at, and they also were very small in number, though, as we're hearing from the data, that now they are growing in number. That's a new middle class formation, but we have to have our theoretical, apples lined up before we start, jumping into them. And just briefly, I would say that I used what I called in that appendix an inclusive and maximalist, if that's possible, definition, drawing on the common ground between Marxist, Weberian, Eric Olin Wright versions of what the middle class is that relied on a definition of salaried employees, small producers, and family producers in commerce, industry, and agriculture. It's very important for me. And state workers. I added state workers. And one key element here was it's definitely a labor process definition, not an income definition, because once you start moving in the world of income definitions in the developing world and you want to try to make comparisons or status, forget it. So I thought labor process was a very important kind of larger starting point. The second thing that I underscore in that appendix is that it was essentially the starting point, not the ending point, because ultimately middle class, it's about middle class formation, not categories, but formation. And formation, especially in the developing world where things, the economy and institutions space, which I'll say a little more about, are changing dramatically, it's important to try to get into the process someplace and then find the variation over time. So that's kind of just methodologically my perspective. I just wanted to underscore that autonomy on the job is an important relative autonomy. So that comes a little from Eric Olin Wright and some of the other definitions of middle classness based on the United States is a part of it. But I think that the scale of production is also really relevant. And again, I'm happy for conversation and my definitions produce some controversy in that book, but I include small producers, which would include the informal sector, small farmers, if you take a labor process position. So that kind of will explain why I'm focusing on the actors that I'm focusing on. So in looking at those kind of those subgroupings that were so relevant, first in the Mexico case, again, I said public sector employees, small scale, commercial industrial producers, I argued in that book that both groups' importance to the politics of development, and again, a caveat, I was focusing on Mexico City, not all of Mexico as a nation. These were high-profile middle-class actors during initial stages of industrial development in a post-revolutionary political environment where building a strong quasi-welfare state was on the agenda, which explains in part the importance and significance of public sector workers. In this environment, both state workers and small-scale industrial and commercial producers served as key political actors who engaged the state in ways that reflected or recast their middle-classness, both subjectively and objectively, which is when you look at formation, you are able to look at both of those dimensions, and whose support for certain development strategies impacted their own livelihood. So in Urban Leviathan, I argue that when middle classes supported the populist project, the size of the state expanded, as did middle class jobs in the state. So in other words, where they were and how they supported the development trajectory fed back on the process of middle class formation. When middle classes supported the more neoliberal model, small factories closed, state employment failed to expand, and large portions of the middle class were relegated to the ranks of the under and unemployed. So that's where informality starts coming in. And there is the point this morning about transition, where were people at one moment and how do they move even in the same generation? In the developing world is really important, and that is absolutely central to understand the shifting boundaries of the economy in the developing world now. So that leads me to a proposition about the historical understanding of the context in which you're looking at middle classes. And you want to look at formation and deformation, in other words, the process. It's not just that you can look at some group and freeze them in time. And in particular, the point here is the focus on the state. I think it has been historically very relevant. It's shifting now, and I'll say something about that in a second. But stated simply, in the developing world and even now, middle class formation occurs in the interstices, not just of market and society, but the state. And you cannot forget the state. That's my first point from my first work. That historical focus of my prior work pushed me to another realization about those two sets of actors, and that is the fact that they were far from homogeneous, as is true with the middle class more generally. In the field of development studies, as alluded to, the concept of the middle classes is itself problematic with the Western focus on salaried or educated professionals, which again are have been the smallest number in the developing world, and seemed almost irrelevant until recently. So what I found most interesting and important for understanding the choice of political alliance making involved in pursuit of certain development strategies was the stark heterogeneity within the middle class more generally, and particularly within state workers and commercial industrial producers. And I don't want to talk too much about that, but there was a lot of interesting, because if you think about the history of state formation, who becomes a state employee in the Mexican case, you have agrarian workers and laborers who are struggling in the fields during the revolution. They get employed by the revolutionary government, and they come into the state alongside more bourgeois educated middle classes, and they became a very important source of political conflict in the transition from one regime to the next. And that's a political regime, but I think we could say in the economic transitions of economic regimes, you have to look at those tensions within the category. The commercial and industrial sector also was very diverse, as you can imagine, size-wise, sector-wise. And remember, I'm saying commercial and industrial. So we're talking about small shopkeepers and small-scale commercial producers who maybe used informal sector in front of their shops but also sold things within it, and then industrial producers, small, as we say in Spanish, talleres, that are actually doing industrial production but four or five or six producers one place. I better move on. Okay, in that environment, my point here is in the environment of the middle-class heterogeneity, either the state, party, or civil society institutions played a critical role in organizing and representing, if not unifying, which was an important political project, these middle-class interests vis-a-vis other classes and the state. In Mexico, the corporatist structures of the state-dominated political party served as key institutions in that regard, but so too did producer organizations that organized autonomously but maintained close worker relations with the state. I think this is, I'm kind of echoing your interest, Devesh, in thinking about professional organizations, but broadening our understanding to think about organizations and institutions and not narrowing it just to professional ones. These institutions established a larger political project and ideological framework through which middle-class preferences, political preferences, were established, adopted, crafted, and articulated. And while they cannot be said to accurately reflect or create any objective unity within the mid-class, they did represent a socially constructed institutional voice that itself influenced development policy and thus middle-class formation on middle-class politics. And just to give you an example, I'm going to give you a couple concrete examples because those are always helpful. First of all, the sector of the party in Mexico that represented the middle classes was called the CNOP, the National Confederation of Popular Organizations, which was identified as representing the popular middle classes. In other words, it was a linguistic construction with social and political objectives. 5 minutes. Impossible. Okay, so I made my point about kind of how middle class, these, I haven't even gotten to the present period, but we can talk about it later. But in my second book, which I moved to the comparison of East Asia and Latin America, I talk about the ways in which these institutions of politics within the state, historical trajectories, as well as discourses and languages produced a middle class unity and formation. And ethnicity comes in the picture in the Taiwan case. So just to parallel the ways in which these groups united around a common project. Okay, the third, what I learned that I didn't really have a handle on when I first wrote the book on Mexico City in the comparison was the importance of widening my view of middle classes beyond the urban and the salaried professionals. And I was forced to do that by looking at East Asia, Taiwan, and South Korea. When I started that project, I kind of thought I was going to be looking at the same actors in both places. But if my objective was to explain development policy, I realized that the same actors weren't relevant for obvious political, historical, urban, national developmental reasons. And that led me to my third proposition that I learned and that I'm putting on the table for us to talk about the present, which is the spatial context. And in particular, when I looked at East Asia and Latin America, I was looking at rural versus urban. Where these folks are, where are they, and again, on top of the institutional and the historical ways that they are organized, but where they are, as I say here, where they are in space affected the alliances that they made and their objectives and their claims and their political orientations. I'm going to have to jump. So how, if anybody, I do have a copy of the paper if anybody wants it. Okay, so that's my third proposition. I want us to think about production and consumption in space. And in the East Asia, Latin America, it really was about what were the forward and backward linkages or supply chains that link classes together or divide them apart, in particular middle class. Migration becomes a part of that. In the East Asian case, a migration from rural to urban area changed the ways that middle classes saw themselves and brought unity between urban and rural middle classes, which created a different developmental project in Latin America. The rural middle classes were completely isolated. It didn't create alliances with hardly anybody. They had no political power for many reasons. It was not just a problem of organization. But if you look at the language of classness in the developing world, you'll find in studies of Latin America, and I know many here know Latin America, that in both the literature and in popular usage, people didn't talk about middle classes very much at all. Everybody that we could say objectively was a small producer in Argentina, they were capitalists or they were laborers. So the language of how you see things gets articulated and reproduced. Okay, what does this have to do with the contemporary challenges? I just want to kind of lay out what I did in the paper was talk a little bit about how globalization, the changing new paradigm, what I'm calling here the ICT service economy paradigm. So moving the prior work was focused on ISI, EOI, other development paradigms. We're in a newer development paradigm. Don't ask me to define it in my 10 seconds here. But what I wanted to do is understand some of the same questions that I was looking at in another paradigm. So again, keep the political economy, but look at differences. And in the paper, I talk a little bit about the ways in which globalization of the economy has changed the nature of the state, which I could summarize by saying is reduced the number of middle classes gainfully employed in the public sector and small and medium-sized industry, and then grown these other parts of the professional class. But this doesn't mean these other classes are disappeared. I think the second thing that it does, it's changed the institutions that represent middle classes. But again, we're talking about a transition where old political institutions, parties, party practices still exist to represent those old middle classes. But now you have new middle classes that are creating new institutions in civil society, NGOs, et cetera. Democratization and decentralization that is part of this project, the summary I would make here is that we see shifting ideological and structural composition of political parties. So that's something I want to put on the table. The importance of not just looking at institutions and the state, but political parties in particular, because historically they've had to deal with groups that we are thinking about as middle classes and the NGOs. And then the third thing that I look at in the paper is space and how rapid and sprawling urbanization has transformed the developing world. And we're going to hear more about that from Landi. So I won't say too much about that on the case of Mexico City, but we are talking about now when I'm thinking about space and the way I think we need to think about it for the project that we're all interested in is with it, the focus now on urban middle classes is really important for historical reasons. There's not a lot of migration, either international or rural urban migration, and that investment, the Sasson-type arguments about global investment in the cities has created cities as central places and spaces where we need to understand middle class diversity and heterogeneity or unity, both spatially, socially, and politically. I make that argument. And I think that what I'm interested in comparing the present from the past and thinking about these three issues are the extent of heterogeneity is more or less than in the past? What is the balance within the groups? And does that balance, is it reflected in the institutions that are available for being involved in politics? I've laid out the three questions about the rural urban, where are they most important politically? And that will be different in all the countries we're talking about here. And what kind of, do they still play this swing role, contradictory class location that Eric and Olin Wright had us think about. So I will end with five hypotheses, and then with no elaboration, but these are the hypotheses that I have based on my studies of these things. I think that we're seeing more tensions and divisions within the urban middle class than within the rural middle classes, leading to new political institutions and social practices in cities, as well as new urban development models which reinforce urban middle class tensions and divisions, and that has to do with gating of communities, offering privatization of public services. I think the growth of the cities is not just the terrain in which we see new professions emerging, educated professionals, but we see transformations in collective consumption practices in the cities that have a direct bearing on middle class formation. That's hypothesis number one. Hypothesis number two, that in the context of in an effort, well, you see it too, to accommodate the minds of the demands of a really divided urban middle class, politicians and political parties are struggling to find new forms and ideologies of inclusion. This might be where not just ethnicity, but religious extremism in the Indian case is going to come in for our discussion later. But in Latin America, there are other new ideologies. There are also the political parties and actors are turning their focus to issues, kind of umbrella issues like insecurity, transportation, and urban sustainability, because they're broad enough to accommodate wide groups of divided middle classes, which, again, are economically divided, socially and spatially divided in the developing world. I only have 5 hypotheses. 3, pressing urban issues and efforts to accommodate them raise larger legal jurisdictional. Okay, you can read. I don't have to read it all out for you, but I wanted to think about the ways in which the efforts of politicians and the states also bring new questions about the law and property rights and the ways and formal and informal ways of contestation. Those are all up for grabs. It's not enough to say that we're going to offer, you know, new housing. We'll hear from Landi or whatever. On what land? And how are you going to guarantee that? And those are important political issues, not just for parties, but for the state and development trajectories and getting foreign investors, et cetera. 4, again, despite, I think, the fact that if you are a politician in the developing world and you live in Mexico City, Mumbai, Joburg, wherever, you know what the urban needs and challenges are. But you are constrained by the changing political terrain, and in particularly, as those of us that work on the civil society, the expansion of the NGOs and civil society as a consequence of prior development trajectories, also the ways that international agencies bypassed the state and political parties and supported NGOs. Now we're talking about a plethora of institutions of civil society, institutions that are in some ways, and this is where I want to have a debate with you, Gregor, competing with the state and political parties, not necessarily working along with them, although I think it would depend on the areas. And this is a terrible challenge for governance and politics. And that is the challenge of, and middle classes, these professional NGO types, middle classes, not just the lawyers and the folks that you mentioned, but, you know, the graduates of MIT, et cetera, that go back and say, well, and all those other things, this is a real important problem. I think that what's interesting about the NGO world is that the kind of way funding has supported, it's fragmented the middle class more. So not only do we have the spatial fragmentation, they're organizationally fragmented with a gazillion different NGOs. Whereas if we think about the model of corporatism and past politics, there were institutions that created unity. And I think that's a challenge. And the last one, all the efforts above can be potentially upended by the political, I mentioned the spatial and political fragmentation of the body politic, urban body politic I'm thinking of, but we could look at it at different scales, generated what I say from above and below. What I mean by that is decentralization and the emergence of community initiatives. So the social fragmentation of NGOs, the gating of community, the privatization of urban services has made it difficult to create social and political ties, middle class and otherwise. And then also from above, I mean the global and transnational networks of actors whose home base is a city, but that has also intensified the trend towards fragmentation. And I'm thinking of 2 constituencies, but I say because it created constituencies with economic power whose allegiance to local governing institutions is limited and whose loyalty lays with alternative imagined communities. And what I mean by that are not just transnational wealthy migrants that are coming back to these cities, but also in the Latin American case, in the Mexican case, the kind of informal sector involved in drugs and trade and illegal smuggling and contraband. These are actors, I've written about them as comprising alternative imagined communities that could care less about the state. They just want to live in an urban economic world where they're not dealing with politics, but they create incredible problems, including violence and insecurity, at least in the latter, that then the state has to deal with. Middle classes care about that, and so it's a part of the process. So in conclusion, I would re-ask the question about what role the middle classes will play in the developing countries of the future. Will they be brought into politics and governing projects, as in the past, in the ways that will reinforce both the democratic franchise and economic prosperity, or will they drive social and spatial fragmentation, class division, and competition for resources and control over space and ways that prevent strong political coalitions from materializing to sustain strong democratic institutions. My fear is the latter, maybe because I work on Mexico and it's falling apart, but only with strong local political leaders with an eye to new forms of local state formation, I want to put that concept on the table, local state formation, will that those outcomes be avoided. Thank you. And I'm sorry I went over my time.
So it's going to be a challenge to talk after Diane Davies, such a challenging talk. So first I would like to thank you for this invitation. I'm very happy to be here because of the company, of course, but also because I have the possibility to think and learn from you about the changing middle class across a variety of contexts. And preparing this presentation, I have the opportunity to consider more explicitly how the composition of the middle class in Mexico is changing, how their housing option has changed also during the 90s in Mexico, and how that has translated into residential segregation patterns in that decade. But before I begin, I would like to make a few clarifications about my presentation. First, my interest on residential segregation stems from my dissertation, who deals with the geographical concentration of poverty and its consequences on individuals' labor trajectories. So, and it draws more on the social stratification literature, and therefore, to think about the political implication of these new residential patterns has been kind of challenging for me. So to what extent, I'm not quite sure if those political implications appears on the paper that I circulated. It was a very, very preliminary draft. So I'm going to try to make a little bit more explicit this implication in this presentation, but I want to be sure that I make clear that it's not by any means an argument, but just a few ideas that I would like to just present to you and keep working on them in the future. The second clarification is that my dissertation focused on the urban poor, but when I look at the residential segregation indexes and during my fieldwork, I noticed that the urban poor were not as isolated as previous studies had suggested, and I myself thought. Across the city, low-income neighborhoods and the so-called colonias populares seem to have a sizable share of middle-class families in these neighborhoods. And there's this better-off household, they don't fit the profile of well-established families. I mean, these were not the type of professional, well-paid families, headed by, for this type of people. But these families were also difficult to classify as poor or low-income families. Moreover, when I interview some of these families, they don't regard themselves as working class, for example. And I know we all classify ourselves as middle class. We always say, I'm middle class, right? But it's not only that. But when I interview, I notice that they have practices that we associate as with the middle class. For example, they keep their kids in school even during economic crisis period, even if that means that the household would struggle seriously during this economic crisis. Something that maybe some other household in the same neighborhoods from a different background won't do that. What I want to ask you today is, and it relates to this question about how we classify or how we define the middle class, is how we deal with this group of people who doesn't really fit the middle class profile, at least not the one that we think usually as this professional headed households, but doesn't fit neither this definition of the poor, low-income household. either. So you are going to see that I'm going to define middle class basically, or not basically, based on income, and that's because of data restrictions, and I'm going to explain in a second why. But my decision to define middle class in a broad sense has to do with this finding in my fieldwork, that because I really try to capture this segment of the population who doesn't fit the low-income category, but is not the professional category either. So I'm struggling with that. So what I'm going to do is define the middle class in a broad sense, and then I'm going to distinguish between different categories of the middle class. And I'm going to end up having different categories of the middle class. So I will have the lower middle class and then the solid middle class, what I call. But I think it has to do with something that Ayan was mentioning, that about trying to get into the heterogeneity of the middle class in developing countries. And I think this is something that I'm going to try to show during my presentation, that is not only, that it shows up actually in the residential segregation indexes, that actually you can detect a different pattern of residential segregation within the middle class groups. So that's something that I'm going to do. And third, my third clarification has to do with the idea that my paper is pretty much a very descriptive paper. It's not as theoretically elaborated as the previous paper, and I really appreciate those papers, but my my approach is really a very descriptive approach, and I'm just going to present some of the analysis that I have been doing about Mexico City. So I'm going to start saying that in general, my talk is going to describe how the middle class contribute to racial segregation patterns in Mexico City in the 90s. And I'm going to do that because this decade implies some changes in the composition and in the housing patterns of the middle class in particular. And those changes occur in a context of economic restructuring, increasing inequality, and changes in the urban development model of Mexico City. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on the historical urban development pattern in Mexico City. I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but I'm going to just give you a little bit of that. So it has been argued that the urban middle class play a central role in the construction of the post-revolutionary political regime as part of the cross-class coalition that made possible to build the hegemonical political party that ruled Mexico over 75 years and the coalition that allowed the stability of the country. Until the 80s, Mexico City profited disproportionately from this regime and through generalized subsidies to the goods and services, these subsidies to goods and services benefit the middle class and the industrial working classes residents that reside in Mexico City to the detriment to other segments of the urban population, but also to the detriment of the rural population. Other ways in which the interest of the middle class was tied to the working class is in the access to houses and the provision of urban services. Although some segments of both classes did have access to subsidized credits, public housing, their numbers were very limited, reaching only a small fraction of the urban household. In fact, the city expanded largely through irregular or informal settlements, through land invasion or land provided by the state. Although many of these neighborhoods were created by poor rural migrant migration to the city, other of these neighborhoods have, since the beginning, a middle-class residence in... I'm going to start again that sentence because it didn't make any sense. So I'm going to start again that sentence. So, although many of these new neighborhoods, these informal settlements, were created by poor rural migrants to the city, other have, since the beginning, a middle class within it. Or, and this happened more often, a proportion of these poor migrants became middle class as social mobility processes were in extent happening in the city during the period of economic growth that went from 1950 to mid-80s, roughly speaking. Middle-class families settle in low-income neighborhoods as a strategy to cope with economic instability. They trade the better quality services and the social prestige of wealthy neighborhoods for larger properties and savings, which were used to purchase services more important for their social mobility, such as private education for their children. This strategy was possible in a context of ample consumption subsidies, and more importantly, with the expectation that the government will provide services and urban infrastructure to these settlements in the short run. These strategies, and in general, weak urban growth planning, seem to have contributed to reduce residential segregation level in the city beyond we could have expected based only on inequality levels. However, economic and political transformation that took place since mid-80s could have altered this pattern. Briefly speaking, we can think about changes in the economic structure for example, the industrialization. Mexico City, in some sense, is the classic example of what has changed to the so-called global cities. So, for example, it lost manufacturing employment. It used to be the main manufacturing city in Mexico. It's not anymore. It consolidates its service economy, although it's important to say that Mexico City has always concentrated federal bureaucracy and the political, economic, and economic elite, but it became more so during the 90s. At the same time, earnings inequality increased during this period. And for example, earnings gains during the 90s were captured basically by the top 10% of the labor market categories. But the 90s were also a very unstable period. You know, the 95 crisis marked this period, so the 95 crisis sent poverty to record levels as a consequence of the impoverishment of the population, inequality levels declined. However, the economy recovered, and by 2000, these trends were reversed. During the crisis, the size of the middle class decreased, but it recovered its volume by 2000. According to some estimates, for example, by 2000, about 30% of the population fit the middle class category, broadly defined, for example. However, what is important to mention is that not all middle class had the same fate during this decade. While some segment of the middle class lost as a consequence of deteriorating employment condition, educational credentials, and the volatility